This episode of AVXL is recorded on January 31st, 2017. We're going to talk the joys of installing a new projector. Is physical media dead? Ultra HD Blu-ray drives for your PC, LCD, or OLED to replace your plasma TV, and so much more.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
Let's talk about my new projector. It's been a couple weeks now, maybe longer.
It nice.
All
came
together. Holy cow, what a difference.
What did you upgrade from?
An Optoma HD180-ish.
Okay, good value, 1080p projector.
Yeah.
Single chip DLP.
Especially since I bought it on... a woot off or hey. A woot out
woot
for like $600. This thing must be, I think it's got to be close to 7 years old now. And
how many lamps did you go through? Many?
Two.
Ah!
The last one exploded. The first one, because okay, so first of all, if you're not familiar with projector lamp lifespans, it is a legitimate issue to look at, especially for in that, you know, sub-$1,000, $1,000 to $2,000 projector arena. Because if you're spending $300 on a lamp and you need three lamps over the cost of the projector, then the lamp or the projector can feel somewhat more expensive than you had anticipated.
Total cost of ownership.
And the projector lamps, generally they don't die, except, of course, this one actually exploded.
Oh, no, they do. Right at the best possible moment, like right before the big game, or
well, this is why you should buy a replacement lamp when you buy your projector, just to have it nearby. But you know, you typically get a couple thousand hours out of one. Some are rated for 3,000 or 4,000 hours. You know, you whenever possible, you want to get a replacement from the manufacturer, because there are some less than
finding quality lamps.
Yeah.
Factory. Ideally, you're going to get it right from the factory.
Yeah.
And it's going to be that original part replacement. But
bad deals on
there
lamps.
There are bargains out there. And if you're careful, yes, you can find a good one. But I prefer, anytime I'm lamp shopping, is get that module. At least, I don't care where it comes from, as long as it's from that manufacturer. Mm-hmm. It's specific for that part.
In a lot of cases, you'll see like the same lamp as specified by, or it's amazing what kind of shows up in the box. and you have to be careful, because you know if I can't buy it directly from the manufacturer, or if the price from the manufacturer is so horrendous, then I start looking at what looks like a reputable lamp, a lamp vendor that has a ton of positive reviews.
I've also seen some places sell just the lamp itself, not the entire module. And I don't think that's really the way for most folks to go. You just want something.
Given that if you get a fingerprint on the lamp and the lamp heats up, there's a pretty good chance that the lamp's going to shatter.
Yeah.
I
wear my latex gloves when I'm touching anything related to that, or cleaning them or whatever. But
nothing says you're in trouble like Robert coming at you with a pair of latex gloves.
You're exactly. It is a sight to behold. Hands of purple. Goodness.
But as the projector gets older, the projector lamp gets older, it fades in brightness, and it can typically fade as much as 50% before
changes
it finally
color too.
Yes.
And the lamp will actually lose most lamps typically lose a little blue light in that first 100 hours, so they tend to be a little different even right out of the box. So
So the new projector is an Epson 3500, which is a 25 lumen projector with basically a brand new lamp. So for the first time in my projector ownership, I don't really care if the lights are on, if the front or the front window's open. I mean, in theory, it's only 800 lumens brighter, but in reality, the old lamp was probably, you know,
big difference.
Well under 1,000 lumens at this point.
The big difference between single-chip DLP versus a three-chip LCD projector like you're using now is color brightness.
Yeah.
For DLP, you're dealing with a single chip with a light source shining through a rotating color wheel, generally speaking, and at any given moment in time, you're only shining through one of the primary colors, or sometimes a white square.
I'm shining through all three simultaneously.
Yeah. So while you generally don't have a brightness difference in a setup like that for absolute luminance, but the color brightness, so when you start mixing color, suddenly on DLP systems, single chip DLP systems, you can have particularly your secondary colors that are mixing two primaries, it can't deliver as much brightness because it is only shining through one little plastic window at a time. And
It's funny, I can hear the color wheels in this one. What I assume is the color wheels.
Well, hopefully,
in this one.
Hopefully it doesn't change in pitch or suddenly fail. But
not so far. Well, you know, it's amazing how much brighter it is. Also amazing how much brighter the room is now.
You were saying two lamps over the life of the product. How many hours
a day?
The
last one. The first one last, we got like 4,000 hours out
of. Okay. Regular usage. That's your main display.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah. The colors are much brighter. The blacks, you know, as affordable projectors advance, or the technology in affordable projectors advance or gets better. There's a sentence in here somewhere, I swear, people. The blacks, you know, my old projector blacks were basically a very dingy gray. And now they actually start to seem like a very light black. You don't get deep blacks on a sub-$2,000 projector.
No, and that thing is a light dumper, too. So yeah. That thing's really optimized more for trying to put out just super bright pictures. And if you turn it way down to its echo mode, that'll help with contrast. That's the best it's going to do in that mode.
We turn it into echo mode. Tick the brightness down a little bit. It's nice that I have to be so anal about
a projector like
killing
that too,
all the light.
I don't think it has any kind of an iris function either to where you can really help. That can really help with contrast performance.
It does have lens shift. That's an actual optical lens shift.
Would you ever buy a projector that doesn't?
Never again. My old one did not. And this was, you know, on this particular projector, it offers like 60%. Lens shift in the vertical plane and 24% lens shift in the left and right. What that essentially means is that you can manipulate or shift the physical, you know, the rectangle of light on the wall. You can physically shift it up and down until it's centered in your screen, which you may be thinking, well, you know, I'll just do the measurement and hang the projector, except it never quite ends up being where you think it's going to be, or it's a few degrees off. And it was, you know, the lens shift allowed me to not have to do any keystoning correction.
Exactly.
And that's the big one you want to avoid.
Digital keystoning, as soon as you enable any of those functions, you're losing half the resolution of the projector. So don't, unless you have to.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of having that lens shift system. Because once you mount the projector, you're effectively moving that thing around on its mount until that light coming out of it is a perfect rectangle with no keystone effect, no trapezoid-shaped light output, regardless of where the screen is. And then at that point, use the lens shift system then to slide that nice rectangle of light right onto the screen and center it up. And I got to tell you, that just makes... Using any of these systems, be it a zoom function on a projector or its lens shift systems, the more you use it, you generally lose some light output, but the functionality of it is such that I would not buy a projector without that for any kind of decent home theater setup. Just it makes life easy. And I noticed you had the 3600, the new 3700's out now for currently listed at $1,350.
Well, I'm way back at the 3500.
Oh, okay. But man, this 3700, just at that price point, that's probably what I would pick for sub $1,500 1080p bright projector, bright room projector, where you just need extra oomph.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, something that made me laugh is that the mounts are still an incredible pain in the tuchus.
And also too that lumen level they always quote, especially for Epson projectors. So if you put it in that crazy bright mode, it is so greenish that the overall image quality, it's effectively unusable. So you're never going to see the max lumen rating on any of these projectors, really, if you have it set up for good image quality, including color and detail.
Oh, my goodness. It's funny. It's funny looking at that Powerlight, Epson Powerlight Home Cinema 3700, which is still 3D.
Oh no!
Well, it's
the chipsets all have that 3D stuff baked in, so these guys aren't going to get rid of that. And I got to tell you, your projector, that new one you have, was one of my favorite 3D experiences because of that extra light output. It really—I mean—you need that extra light for, especially with the active shutter glasses, where one eye is closed at any given moment in time or blocked, so you're perceiving two separate images that way. But again, now you now have a sweet 3D display. you had before, but now it's effective. One thing on three-chip projectors, though, that differs from the single-chip DLP is convergence of the imaging internally. So with a three-chip system, you're dealing with red, blue, and separate red, blue, green images, and it's really important to put up a crosshatch pattern that's like a white crosshatch, and to make sure and look really carefully at it and see if there's any fringing on those white lines. Is there a blue edge on one side and a red on the other? You need to basically get both of those to come back onto green, so it's nice and tight. And every three-chip projector needs a little tweak on that right out of the box. That will dramatically improve overall.
I'm trying to think if I
clarity of the picture.
Have That's a 3D super important Blu-ray thing that I can name.
The single chip DLP systems, on the other hand, are doing all the mixing through a single light path. So it's like you don't have to really, there is no convergence issue there. So that's one convenience.
Oh, I wonder if our copy of Kubo and the Two Strings is in Blu-ray 3D.
Kubo.
Maybe we have the 47 Samurai. But
it has a 3D conversion mode, most likely, as well.
So oh, my goodness. Well, I bring that up because it is official. LG and Sony have acknowledged, I guess, in an article with CNET that they are not, are no longer, and will not be running 3D programming, or basically building 3D televisions.
Yeah.
Fierce Cable has a funny article. Quote, the move comes 4 years after DirecTV decided to end its 24-hour 3D programming channel, which is 3 years after ESPN dropped its 3D channel.
There's some development money to be saved if you can ignore 3D in a television set environment. And for anybody doing an OLED, nobody did 3D. I'm almost convinced now because of that filter that had to be added for producing a 3D image. It actually blocked light. So, some light. So, in order to... HDR is more important than 3D. that's the messaging I am absorbing from the manufacturers.
Well, the thing that made me laugh was Bruce Sterling, the science fiction author / futurist, had tweeted out, 3D display technology never really dies. It just retreats to deep shadows and waits for another vogue, which is harsh, but I think fair.
True. It's VR now. Go crawl into your cave and put your VR headset on and lock the doors. And
I will say about VR, it's much less difficult to mount a VR system than it is to mount a projector. Projector mounts...
I've only dealt with the most basic VR so far. Samsung Gear, that's the limit of my VR experiences. So,
you know, with the HTC Vive, it's like you mount a couple boxes on the wall and you're good to go. It was interesting. I ended up having to cobble together. I couldn't find the mount I bought for the projector, which I actually have in my truck to give to you in case you could use it. I ended up reusing my old mount after cobbling together using some old HDTV extra bits from a HDTV wall mount to get the... There's no like...
Limit to the amount of spare parts I have for mounts now.
In theory, right? These are all VASIS. You know, my old projector was a very weird, very proprietary mount. And the new projector was, in theory, some type of VASA mount that I could not find anything that would attach to. So I ended up, you know, a little bit of Home Depot, some extra bolts.
you're cobbling. But you did it, though. And you got it installed. Looking good.
It's so stable.
Everyone's
so
happy.
Nice. Sonny wrote us a long email, which basically comes down to, should I buy the LG OLED B6 or Samsung's KS8000 to replace a Panasonic plasma screen? He's about image quality above all, followed by size and price. And because of some family experiences, friend and family experiences, he is deeply concerned about reliability, especially from LG.
As far as OLEDs go, there really is no long-term, super long-term
assessment
yet of what happens to an OLED panel in terms of image quality. I'm not that concerned about overall life as long as you're not full-on abusing the panel in a sense like high-contrasted frying white lines on the screen and leaving them there a la burn-in. However, for image quality and coming from a plasma background, a Panasonic plasma at that, he had the ST30, I believe. Mm-hmm. That Panasonic plasma did exceptional black level at no matter where you sat in the room. And it did it very well. And so if you sit in a dark room and you want to recreate that plasma viewing experience, it's going to be very hard to do that with any LCD. The OLED would definitely be the easier way to go. That said, the contrast performance of Samsung's panels are excellent. That KS8000 will do fantastic looking HDR without a doubt. It's only in those letterbox movies, you're sitting in a pitch black room, and depending on how you're sitting and looking at that TV, you may be able to perceive a little bit of glare in the corners from the backlight system leaking through. And that's really about it. And other than that, yeah, half the price for an LCD, generally speaking, compared to the OLEDs. But that OLED contrast performance, that dark room viewing superiority, is really tough to beat. So, yeah, I say if you generally view TV in a dark room environment, go OLED if you can. And as far as protecting that investment, I almost never see a TV dead right out of the box. I can't think of the last time I saw that. As long as the box wasn't damaged, it wasn't, you know, drop kicked down the flight of stairs or whatever. I will say that it is very important to not only get the TV out of a new TV out of its box carefully and according to the plan, but you got to get it installed properly as well. And that includes making sure that base stand's attached just so. Even better, wall mount that sucker. That's added protection. And while you're doing all of this setup, be very careful about flexing that chassis. Even OLEDs are thin enough, but I've seen rather name brand TVs out of the box that are apparently brand new that were supposedly flat screens that weren't so flat. And I won't name names, Vizio, but it makes me wonder if somebody just did an eyeball down the set before they bought it, which how can you do if it's still in the box? But that just, just being careful with these, especially ultra-thin OLED chassis. They can bend a little bit.
And the thinner they get, the more likely they are to bend. I mean, there's some amazing material engineering and design going into a lot of these ultra-thin televisions.
I will say, the OLEDs I saw at CES that actually had bent corners or something. Not a lot, but dinged for sure. They were still functioning just fine. Those panels can clearly take a little flexing, but
a little.
Yeah. But the whole thing is just once you've ensured it's pristinely delivered out of that box and into the viewing environment, just make sure it isn't touched. I mean, get your cables hooked up, put everything away, get that thing on the wall out of reach. that I find goes a long way toward just extending that warrant or extending your investment and other things too. If you're buying a television nowadays, I find that every credit card I look at in terms of the benefits for it generally will extend every warranty on electronic purchases for at least a year past the warranty you had. So if that warranty on your TV from the manufacturer, somehow that TV went pop like a couple months after the warranty expired, go check how you purchased it and look up that information, because that's just an easy way to get something fixed. And likewise, too, if you have a problem with the TV or any electronic device, stay calm and call the manufacturer.
Yeah.
And at least get something going in terms of, you know, reporting the problem, letting them see if they can come up with a solution for you. It's the folks that just stew in stuff and never do anything about it. And, you know, you bought a product. It comes with some customer care. Especially if you're having a problem with it, and that'll be the sign of a good or a bad company too, in terms of how they deal with you. But a lot of it is, man, I just ran into somebody who basically took a new product out of the box. There was something clearly wrong with it, but they immediately went yelling at the manufacturer, and they didn't. It was like that. It wasn't really a deep. It was maybe dead on arrival. You should have went back to the person you bought it from and just refunded it, replaced it. Instead, you're getting upset about the wrong things and Anyway, trying to say that
it seems like no matter how good your QC is, about 3% of the products, you know, on a good company, are going to be DOA or have some other issue.
Totally.
And whether that's, you know, shipping problems or, you know, the attack of the gremlins or whatever it might be, no matter how good a company is, there's still going to be some DOA products. And don't take it personally. I understand. Like, there's nothing more irritating than having to pay to ship something back or to having to sit around and wait for Amazon to pick that up or to box the SOB back up and take it back to Costco on a Saturday when the parking lot's full and you can't find a cart. But, you know, maintain calm. Call, and in a lot of cases, the manufacturers, especially for smaller companies, you'd be shocked how hard they'll work. Because they don't want a negative rating, or they don't want a return and a chargeback from a retail vendor. So, in any case,
it's tough. But like I said, too, as far as image quality goes, those are great options all around.
Dark rooms, LG OLED, HDR, a little bit of an advantage to Samsung.
Definitely. Man, they have that color performance. It's so good in the bright scenes and HDR. It really looks fantastic.
Nice. We've been talking about Ultra HD Blu-ray drives and ripping 4K Blu-rays or playing them back. Not that you can actually do that yet. But Pioneer has announced Ultra HD Blu-ray drives, 5 1/4 inch optical drives. Nantech, I think, found this buried on their Japanese website. Both are going to offer support for UHD Blu-ray playback when UHD playback software is finished from the last vendor standing.
So true.
SATA 3 drives, the BDR-S11 and the JBK, or no, the BDR-11 J-BK and the BDR-S11 J-X. These are, as far as we know, the world's first Ultra Blu-ray drives. There are Blu-ray drives that will currently read 4K Blu-rays, but we don't know if you can actually get the data off the Blu-rays.
This is true.
You know, this is the Nantech article does a pretty good job of walking through the fact that, you know, along with the optical disc drive, your GPU, the GPU driver, the display, the playback software, all has to be compatible, running the AACS 2.0 support. You know,
and it has to be a Kaby Lake processor involved. So, yeah, you're going to be able to build that Blu-ray drive or your ultra high def Blu-ray playback.
You know, the nice thing
into
is,
a PC
is that Kaby Lake's got, you know, the space on the chipset to reduce CPU consumption for H.265 decoding. So it'll take like 10% of your home theater PC's processor instead of
I can't believe 40 or 50%. Any video decoding takes all that much.
People have run benchmarks, whether or not they're legit or not.
Although it all comes into play if you're going like cross country and you need to watch 3-4 movies around the world.
In theory, Power DVD from CyberLink will play back 4K Blu-rays eventually. Not, you know, they basically have said they will support it. They just haven't said when.
And I know a lot of folks aren't even interested in physical media, discs, Blu-ray, ultra high def Blu-ray, but they continue to be the gold standards for source material. For if you can watch any movie in that format, if you have a capable display, you'll never see it better than having that high bitrate. No internet lagging. You have the superb compression. Less compression compared to any streaming format.
Dark scenes
are the big ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Dark scenes are big ones. I was blown away. This was several years ago. And looking at the difference between Downton Abbey on Netflix versus Downton Abbey on Blu-ray. I can't remember now if it was Netflix or iTunes versus the Blu-ray, but it was astonishing how pale and faded the colors were by comparison, like they're just not saturated and some lower level details. It's tough. I get, because a lot of people are like, "Meh, I haven't bought physical media in years." And I'm like,
I understand.
It's great unless you suddenly stop wanting to use an Apple TV and you've got $3,000 in movies tied up in your Apple TV, or if you want to start using an Apple TV, but you've got all of your movies tied up in Amazon Prime. But, you know, it can be fun to sort of A-B between your favorite movie, you know, on a Blu-ray and your favorite movie on a streaming service, just to see if you see a difference. Speaking of which, Ars Technica writes up that Sony missed the writing on the wall for DVD sales, takes nearly $1 billion write-down.
That's a good tax write-off.
Or writes Saras Farivar, in corporate speak, the loss was mainly driven by the acceleration of market decline. So,
I'm curious if that, does that include Blu-ray sales as well or just DVD? Because I could see that at this point, maybe.
Well, the decline in DVD and Blu-ray market was faster than we anticipated, Takashi Iida, Sony spokesperson, told Bloomberg News.
We are an all-you-can-eat society.
Yeah, but Ghostbusters and Angry Burns.
Angry Burns?
Angry Birds. Angry Burns.
Angry Birds! More movies.
Release the Hound, Smithers.
Things I will not see.
I want to see Angry Burns.
Yes.
The new Simpsons movie. But that was also, I think, a big part of it was DVD and Blu-ray, but a big part of it was also a couple of very expensive movies. It did not do very well. So, if you've been thinking that you haven't seen a lot of DVDs or Blu-rays lately, it might be because there's not. Vizio SmartCast devices are now compatible with Google Home, should you be a Google Home owner.
Excellent.
Chrome plays FLAC natively as of Chrome 56. I love the note on this one. quote, support for FLAC and Chrome, that would be the lossless audio format, has been requested since 2011 with momentum gaining in 2015. However, work did not get underway until last September, and its final release coincides with Firefox 51 getting the feature later this month.
Huh. That's browser's adding lossless audio support. Well, I use Chrome already for looking at PDF documents. Mm-hmm. I almost never install a separate PDF reader anymore. Actually, most of the browsers nowadays will read a PDF, which is handy as hell. And if they'll play my FLAC files too, I guess, but I'm not like replacing VLC with that or anything. So that's
something to consider.
Or I guess, you know, if you want to do lossless audio tracks on a website or something like that for some reason, now at least you'd have it built into the browser as far as support goes. But I don't know. I'm just trying to find use cases here.
Oh my goodness.
I'm struggling.
The Kef LS50, the wireless version, which...
God, those look gorgeous.
They are, and they sound gorgeous. Got digitalaudioreview.net's product of the year 2016. I've been meaning to mention that. I found that at CES, but it's an interesting look because a question we got on Tech Thing, I got on Tech Thing recently was asking, like, what is the real difference between studio monitors and speakers and powered monitors? And, right, you know, you can get into the idea of a near field monitor, which is designed for an audio engineer or a video editor to have sort of on their desk and by their skull so they can listen to the soundtrack.
I consider the LS50s close to that now. Aren't they pretty directional?
They are. I mean, they're not too bad.
Okay. Would you use those to fill a room, or is that more for...
Oh, God.
Personal listening?
I would use those to fill a room.
Okay.
I would use the LS50s to fill a room in a heartbeat. At Rocky Mountain Audio Fest...
Beautiful design.
Kef did a pretty gutsy demo with the LS50 and their Blade speakers. And the LS50s, you know, cost like $1,400 a pair. And the Blades cost $25,000 a pair. And it was shocking to hear how good they were going, you know, as they went back and forth between these giants, you know, six-something-foot-tall speakers.
Oh, cool.
And these little tiny bookshelf-sized speakers.
Decent-sized room?
It was a hotel room, but it was still a 15 by 18 or 15 by 20 foot hotel room. But what's interesting, the mini monitors, they're not cheap. They're about $2,000. But what's crazy about the LS50, what they call the wireless speakers, is they took a lot of lessons they learned from the Egg speakers, and the you know, these are the self powered or the built in amplifier is what really the version is, the one that the Digital Audio Review is so excited about. But we heard these at CES, and they're crazy. You know, it's got like a 230-watt amplifier built in, you know, split across the tweeter and the mid-range. You can stream to it from iOS, from Android. It's got a, you know, output for a discrete subwoofer. It's got a subwoofer output on it. It's a pretty fantastic piece of engineering. It's got a built-in DAC. You can stream to it via Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, USB connection, Toslink input, RCA analog input.
There's a convenience factor of having the amp built into the speaker. And after talking to the Texas Instruments folks at CES, they were doing analog amplification.
Yeah.
0 to 100,000 hertz of processing at minimal noise
and
clean and efficient and cheap. So, you know, seeing the performance and hearing it, I have no problem of going with an amplified speaker system if that's the best setup for you in that scenario.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, what the heck? If you can have a separate amp, separate preprocessor and everything else, hey, that's the way I would want to do it, but...
No, but this
there's always going to be a need for powered speakers.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that like Kef's saying is like, yeah, you can go out and buy, you know, $2,000 worth of amplification gear or an amplifier and a preamplifier or a receiver and feed these speakers, or you can buy these speakers and have all of that built in. I was impressed at how good they sounded. You know, they've got some settings you can tweak around with to do sort of timing correction. You know, which is the idea. It's, you know, basically keeping the high and the low frequencies in phase by depending on how their release is. It was, you know, if you don't want to deal with having to, like, if you want a really nice pair of speakers, and I've read some people are kind of saying they feel like this is the future, in that you will have a discrete speaker with the amplification, and in this case, the DAC is built in, right? There's an Ethernet connection on it. It also uses Ethernet to connect to the left speaker. you know, I was really impressed. But I mean, you could sit around there and you know, you could connect your game console to it. You can connect your television to it. You can stream to it from your phone. If you want some badass.
It opens up wireless possibilities too, yeah, with that as well, since you're not dealing with running power.
Right. Well, you're running power
to an electrical outlet nearby, but yeah.
It was, you know, I was impressed by how good they sound. Yeah, you know, but, you know, again, they are not inexpensive, but, you know, they are also super, super clean.
I'm still fantasizing about those Revel speakers.
Yeah, those are pretty, you know, $20,000 a pair and $50,000 worth of hardware feeding them. They yes. should be.
Yes. Yes. More of that.
Yeah. I mean, there's two DACs and two amplifiers inside each of the LS50s. It'll handle 24-bit, 192 kilohertz audio. It's pretty fascinating to look at. They get pretty nerdly in those speakers. But
because for things like Atmos Audio, I'm mm-hmm. more interested now in the preprocessors that just eliminate the amplification altogether and just give me the processing with the channel outputs.
Right.
Ideal over that beautifully balanced XLR jack wired speaker connectors. Yeah. And, you know, that to me is just, it simplifies everything. And whether or not, I don't know, I generally would rather have a separate amp, but, you know, it all depends on the setup I'm doing or the room. So
there's something to be said about the convenience of just basically putting two speakers on two stands and plugging it in and connecting it to your network and just
Ultimate TV speakers.
What's that?
Ultimate TV speakers.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty impressive.
And then some.
Oh, my goodness. Good review if you want to read that up on digitalaudioreview.net. Speaking of speaker stands, Bookshelf speakers, whether we're talking about like a $500 speaker, you know, like the Elax Unify, or a $279 speaker like the like their debut, which are two fantastic entry-level speakers. They need to be...
Oh gosh, I had those Take Energy Classics, man.
Yeah.
They're not the biggest speakers in the world, yeah, but...
Most speakers aren't designed to be shoved up in a bookshelf or up against a wall, especially not if there's a port at the back of the speaker. So, you know, you should have a set of speaker stands for those. You know, like everything else in audio, you can spend $94,000. The Pangea LS200 was a really great, like, $75 option. Those are no longer for sale. But Pangea, which I want to say is an Audio Advisor brand, they're like $100 on Amazon now. Maybe for the 32 or 36 inch version, they're up to like $125 a pair. You can fill those with lead shot or sand or whatever craziness you want to get into. It's an option on that one.
Very nice.
But something to do that. I've also was laughing because I forgot it's getting really hard to find Blue Tack. I ended up getting like Fun Tack from the giant big box store, but to use that to attach the speaker to the stand to make it less likely for the children to knock it off.
Yeah, the random bump.
Yeah. So yeah, about a centimeter size. I cut each piece of Fun Tack in half, rolled it into a ball, stuck it on top of the, you know, stuck like three pieces on top of the platform on top of the speaker stand, and then shove the speaker down.
Smaller speakers will have a like a tripod mount style device on there, and then those can be used with other types of floor standing stands that, you know, you physically attach the speaker mm-hmm. to it. But in a lot of cases, it's just like that. It's a flat top to the base stand, and you're just setting the speaker on top of it. So having a little stickiness there, something to make that connection a little less tenuous.
Just make the connection, people. Oh, man. Charles M., a.k.a. Michael M. 6501, tweets, any recommendations on fairly inexpensive 4K HDR HDMI cables? You're good to go with the current HDMI 2.0 compatible. You know, our sort of, you know, choice at this point is just Amazon Basics. You get 2 6-foot cables for like $12, $11.
Totally. Unless you need to run them in wall. Mm-hmm. In that case, you know, you gotta make sure you get something rated for that.
Or if you're running like more than 25 meters or
25 feet,
pardon me.
Yeah.
Then you might want to spend some money for an advanced cable. But, you know, I like, you know, if I'm not grabbing the Amazon Basics, which is the majority of what's connecting my system together, getting some 2-foot interconnects from Monoprice for $3 a pair is pretty fantastic. Yeah. I feel like we got pretty in depth on HDMI 2.1, you know, and dynamic HDMR. But that's not going to show up until the end of this year at the earliest, and it's not going to gain any kind of speed until 2018.
And the more I look at HDMI 2.1, I guarantee now I'm believing that no TV is going to be upgraded for it. it's for any of the main functionality besides maybe the dynamic metadata for HDR10. That might be the only thing that's going to come through to that, to the current gen of TVs. So don't worry so much about HDMI 2.1 yet, although I would like that audio return channel to add support for our well, Atmos, DTS:X, and all our other...
Well, just upgrade to a 2.1 compatible 4K television next year, and you'll
then
get
again,
the...
it's like the only reason I would even need that is because I'm going to use the apps built into the TV. And at this point, man, I am done with apps and TVs, pretty much. I am so much happier with the Chromecast Ultra or a Roku with HDR support.
I should explain that I was verbally abusing Robert last week until he admitted that it was just time to give up on applications inside of TVs.
I realized that I have a year-old Samsung now. 20, was it the JS series? Have a couple of them, and the YouTube app built into those actually doesn't do, or was it the YouTube app? Yeah, the YouTube app doesn't do HDR, but the one on the Chromecast does. So I was just like, sure, that's annoying. Will it ever be updated? Maybe. But then I also realized too, it wasn't just Samsung. Actually, I think on the LG platform too, their YouTube app also did not support HDR. And I was doing some HDR testing. And I noticed, too, with a lot of these HDR files I find on YouTube currently, they often put in parentheses, look at this on a Chromecast. So, on a Chromecast Ultra or a Roku with its HDR support, some of the newer ones. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, keep that separate. I know why. This kind of goes back to everyone who's ever told me, I really just want a dumb TV. And it's like, yeah, you know.
Buy a projector.
Can I just get a monitor? A monitor with no smarts at all and a built-in HDMI switch. Maybe a 4K switch. That'd be
maybe.
That'd be the only additional functionality I ask for. So.
Speaking of audio return channel, Mike writes, ask at AVXL.com. Hi, Patrick and Robert. My receiver recently died. I decided to ditch my dedicated surround setup for a much simpler soundbar. I understand that virtual SRAM will never match actual surround, but in my oddly shaped living room, proper speaker placement is essentially impossible, so I'm already making compromises. I'm looking to buy the Onkyo SBT-A500 you talked about on your last episode, which has a mini receiver coupled with it. My question is this. If I buy some future streaming device that pumps out Dolby Vision and Dolby Atmos, will that mini receiver be able to pass DV to the TV? It seems like it should based on what I've read, but nothing seems definitive. Should I not even worry about virtual Atmos as I'm only running a soundbar and looking to a cheaper or different soundbar? Thanks for continuing to keep us educated, Mike. Anything that passes through HDMI 2.0 should go through the Onkyo just fine. In terms of like, if you are playing a Blu-ray and running the Blu-ray output into the that Onkyo SBT-A500, it will strip out what it needs to do the Dolby Atmos thing, and it will spit Dolby Vision or HDR video to your television or your projector.
Should
you be running
good to go?
That should not be. That should not be a particular problem.
I will say just generally about the sound modes built into just TVs, if you're not using any speakers at all, definitely take a look at those settings, because I often find that virtual 3D mode in the TV actually can sound better than the TV's default setting.
Yeah.
It can make voices clearer, or it'll have specific modes for people with hearing issues one way or another to help tweak it. But definitely take a look at through all of the branded audio manipulation that goes on in the TV and see if something actually just sounds better to your ear. Mm-hmm. That's a good one to try. Yeah. However, Dolby Vision, no problem. If you've got a TV capable of it, but trying to do Dolby Atmos with a soundbar.
Your mileage is going to vary. It depends on the ceiling in the room, but
it looks like a convenient setup. Yeah. So if that's really, I'd be aiming at that. I'd really make sure that it appears that it will pass through all of your current formats and future formats. I don't think you're going to have any problem there. I want to say that Dolby Vision really doesn't even require HDMI 2, but I think it can be. I won't get into that.
In terms of the SBT-A500, that Onkyo home theater in a box, it should have zero issues passing through HDR to your television. It does Dolby Atmos, it's got a couple of angled speakers at the far left and right of the soundbar that it's going to be bouncing it off your ceiling.
That'll give you a great taste of the convenience of an AVR as well, in terms of being able to plug all your devices into that, have the audio processed to full quality of the capability of the system, mm-hmm. and deliver that. And to then minimize maybe the connections going to the TV to a single cable, which just cleans up everything. So
yeah, the thing to remember about that receiver that comes with that SBT-A500, it is not a full home theater surround sound receiver.
Totally.
So if you decide you want to upgrade to speakers in the future, you will be buying a new AVR.
Something else.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't get too obsessed about Atmos at this point until you have a title. For example, Gravity. If you're a huge fan of the movie Gravity, you might want to go all out for the Atmos settings.
I have been looking at preprocessors lately, and I'm pleased to see for this year, just about everyone, at least in the high end, most of these are like in the $2,000 to $2,500 category, but there are a lot of like fully capable 11-channel preprocessors out there now, and I'm just like, oh, I want to build.
How much do they cost?
About $2,000 to $2,500, depending on, unless you get into the super high end where they don't list prices, and you should even,
if you have to ask.
Yeah, if you have to flinch,
you can't afford it.
Don't do it. Don't do it. No flinching.
No flinching. What's the matter with flinching?
Hey, I saw LG OLEDs. I was working on a B6 this week, and it had the new firmware that added the HDR game mode.
Ooh.
So I guess that came out late last year. So if you have one of these wonderful TVs, these LG OLEDs, there should have been a software update that's automatic. If you have it set up to do those automatic updates, which you should, and let me see what that number was. Apparently, any version greater than 04.30.77 adds the HDR game mode for reduced lag. And that should be especially pleasing to any of the high-end console owners who are looking to do a little HDR gaming. And it's always nice to see good software. Man, I was tweaking the white balance on an LG OLED, and it seems like I'm always learning something new every time I work on one. And I will say, those are fantastic displays to work on, too.
It's always a little frightening that there's more to be learned.
However, I will say that there are multiple menu options for applying video settings to all inputs. It's like there's one on the top menu, and then buried within the menu is another one to apply those settings, which are technically within the sub-menu anyway. It's not perfect for this apply to all thing on TVs, let me tell you.
Oh, my goodness. I may be the only person in North America that actually liked the movie Battleship for its movie qualities, its compelling story and delightful battles. But it's actually
based on the board game?
Yes, for all intents and purposes.
Okay.
With all of the writing
brilliance. How did I miss
this? You would expect. I can't believe you haven't seen it. Oh, my God. Alexander Skarsgård, Taylor Kitsch, Rihanna, Liam Neeson. It is a fantastic piece.
Well, if Rihanna's in it, then damn.
Yeah.
I'm there.
The Battleship Iowa is in it. I mean, how can you not get excited? I like that movie a lot because I am what I am. But a lot of people who wanted a spectacular Blu-ray for demoing their system were kind of curious how the new 4K Blu-ray came out. Nice review of that up on Blu-ray.com. I'm just going to read this paragraph. Universal has re-released the critically panned but reference quality technical dazzler Battleship to the UHD format with a new 2160 HDR enhanced picture presentation and an upgrade in sound with a DTS:X offering. If nothing else, the material seems like a showcase for both and the audio in particular. How does it stack up against the original and technically acclaimed Blu-ray? Hint, this disc rocks.
Well, now.
So if you're looking for a Blu-ray disc to show off your home theater, if not your taste in movies,
that might have sold me just for image quality.
Yeah,
I own more Blu-ray discs that I have watched probably 100 plus times, yet have probably listened to the audio on maybe once or twice. I'm just generally looking at visual quality. I'm not looking at the audio side of it.
Yeah, it's a Peter Berg film. It's a fun watch. Pinocchio's out on Blu-ray. Not a new transfer if you happen to have an earlier version of Pinocchio on Blu-ray. It's part of the series of discs that Disney is reissuing. They've done a whole bunch of them in the last couple of years. I was going to say P- Pinocchio and Snow White. And what was the other one? Oh, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Beauty and the Beast. And they're all part of the signature collection of Blu-ray releases. Because Disney likes to release something on DVD or Blu-ray and then disappear it for a while to sort of create demand. But yeah, it's a pretty solid transfer of a pretty old movie if you are into collecting that. Lair of the White Worm also came out on Blu-ray this week.
Yeah.
It is a classic Ken Russell flick, if any Ken Russell flick can be called classic. I bring this up not because I think everybody should know about this movie, but because like a lot of 80s films, time and high-resolution transfers are not particularly friendly to them because it wasn't considered, you know, it wasn't something where somebody, you know, took a lot of time to safely store the negatives or it wasn't shot on, like, you know, people are like, when's Buffy the Vampire Slayer going to come out on Blu-ray? And the answer is probably never, because the first, you know, year was shot in standard def on the cheapest film stock they could buy because it was such a lark for the television network.
Digitize your content, people.
Well, at this point, you know, digitizing wasn't an option, and they were operating under extraordinary, you know, those are going to be, I hope they come out on Blu-ray at some point, but they are not going to be pretty for the first couple seasons. But and then you could say a lot about 80s movies. There are a lot of 80s movies that were shot cheap and fast and on crappy film stock that are not aging well.
I picked up two 80s films this week, Yellowbeard and Strange Brew on Blu-ray. I don't really remember if Yellowbeard. I remember loving it as a young person. I thought it was the greatest pirate movie ever, and I will go back and see. I will see how it holds up reviewing it. But those two, as you mentioned, and I'm actually glad I bought them because they are old, clearly shot on film, lots of grain noise, and it is. I'm finding it good content to see how these TVs are processing like an interlaced video. Like I'll feed it to the TV in a 1080i format and just to see what it's doing in terms of which TV is doing better enhancement for this older content. Which one has better noise reduction? Which one has noise reduction I can totally eliminate? Or because sometimes TVs, you turn the switch off and there's still something going on and you have no control over it. And anyway,
it's always a little awkward.
So that was one thing I'm actually glad I picked up a couple of old movies for, but
oh man, yeah, I've been playing around with the Roku 4. The Roku 4, I love the Roku 4. I will say the transitions between applications or titles are a little more jarring, a little less elegant than they are on an Apple TV, or for that matter, you were pointing out a Chromecast. But the flip side of that was A, you know, it is really fast, and B, Amazon Prime is on there.
Yeah.
And it feels like there's a lot more new movies on Amazon Prime than there are on Netflix these days.
I find myself looking there more.
Yeah.
Which is something I really kind of ignored for a while.
I think Netflix has said essentially that they're going to be concentrating more and more on original content. But there's moments when I'm looking at the new titles on Amazon and the new titles on Netflix and really feeling that. Plus, of course, I get it for free with my Amazon Prime membership. But, you know, I was really enjoying Poldark, which is a BBC series about a Brit who has returned home from the wars in the Americas and is bringing his father's estate back to life. Season 2, Man in the High Tower, have you started it yet?
No,
or are you holding off?
No, I think I'm going to try to finish Black Mirror on Netflix.
Okay.
That was just so
horrifying.
Yeah, it was. Those first two episodes, honestly, it was just... I'm still afraid, but I heard the rest of it. I heard those first two were like the punches in the gut, and then the rest is not so much. And then I heard second season was like a meh. So I'm just want to plow through that. But what else am I looking at right now? Oh, I picked up a title called Side by Side, and here's yet another video I've looked at a handful of times already, and not listened to the audio on. But this is one I will definitely be listening to. It's a Keanu Reeves project, and basically it's. The subtitle is Can Film Survive Our Digital Future? And it talks with a bunch of famous directors and content creators, and it shows some reasons and feelings about what made film so special and what it is in terms of a media to record to, and is this transition to digital just totally wiping out something special or not? Or are we actually going to end up with something even better in the end? Anyway, it's just an interesting, if you're into film and digital photography and things like that, I think this would be an interesting title to check out just for the listening to people like, you know, Martin Scorsese and James Cameron and Lucas and many others. Just
give some real world examples of here's how they're using it. Here's how it's worked for me in the past as I made the transition from film to digital, mm-hmm. and the ins and outs of it. And it's, you know, definitely not a, you know, a rewatcher for everyone, but, but something kind of neat. And, I'll be sure to link that up. And it's, I think I picked it up for like $8. It's awesome.
Nothing wrong with an $8 Blu-ray. Oh my goodness. Man, let's see. You're going to have a review of the Mass Fidelity audio player. You've got some televisions you're playing around with there.
Oh, you know what? I mentioned last week that I was looking at the, or last episode, I mentioned I was looking at the Hisense H10C, and it's actually the H8C that I'm looking at. And initial testing, just to mention, they have the H8D version coming with the quantum dot upgrade. But the H8C, if you can still find it, I think the 50-inch version is well under $500, calibrates beautifully. And I have to say, I'm side by siding it with a much more expensive TV, and for standard definition up conversion, it is doing a fantastic job.
Nice.
So, hats off to the Hisense folks. I like it, and they have a menu system that remembers the last few things, like a history function built mm-hmm. into the menu. So, if you went deep into there to find some arcane setting, you don't have to go traipsing back through that path again. It's just like right on the top. And
that's pretty cool.
Small touch, but I really did appreciate it. And as long as I'm doing corrections and amplifications, I think I also mentioned that Nanosys, the quantum dot company, was owned by Samsung. And let me just say that they are most likely are not, I would say. I would say it's more of a strategic partnership. Samsung is an independent company. I will leave that at that. And if I was unclear about that quantum dot roadmap coming up, next year will be where they actually integrate the red and green quantum dot materials onto the color filter. They're calling that photoemissive. And then in 3 years, we'll get the electroemissive. So there will be a color filter there. What they're eliminating really is the need for a separate sheet of impregnated quantum dot materials. Why not just build that into the color filter itself? And that will be the next round. Coming up next year, which will not only improve color, brightness, and most importantly, viewing angles. So, really looking forward to that. Anything else I'm screwing up? Let me think here. Let's see. Oh, we were talking about all the new HDR formats, including the new Technicolor format on the last episode, too. One thing to keep in mind is HLG, the hybrid log gamma format. You will almost never see that anywhere except for live production and likely streamed from a satellite or cable provider, or maybe even broadcast at some point when it's compatible with our displays. You'll almost never see that in packaged content like you will for HDR10, Dolby Vision, and the new Technicolor format. Those will be post-production tools and stuff to optimize content that's been captured, and they have time to run it through their workflows. That's not for the live side of things at all.
Got it.
That's where HLG really is the one to pay attention to, because all our sports programming and
sports ball,
any kind of live stuff, if they're going to do it in HDR, it's most likely going to be HLG. So
there you have it.
Awesome. It's awesome.
Ladies and gentlemen, with that, we're going to bring this episode of AVXL to a close. If you've never seen AVXL before, do yourself a favor, go to avxl.com and check out all the information on subscribing, getting more or older episodes. If you'd like to help keep AVXL flowing, do us a favor and join us at patreon.com/AVXL, because we are brought to you by the grace of your donations, or your patronage, as it were. Our next patron hangout should be taking place in the next week. We will send you an email. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.